You're listening to English for Everyone. Tweet us and follow us on Instagram at EU Radio English. And find us on Facebook, EU Radio Nantes English.
101.3 FM.
Hello people, you're listening to English for Everyone here on EU Radio Nantes, and I'm joined over the phone for my first interview in quite a while with none other than Dave Tattersall, i.e. the vocal side and guitar side, or some of the guitar side of the group Wave Pictures, a group that I am hugely fond of. Since kicking off the group in 2003 under the name Wave Pictures, they released 15, 16 albums, something ridiculous like that, as well as the other collaborations they've done with other artists from the same kind of world, Stanley Brinks, Jeffrey Lewis, Darren Heyman, and Fresh Yard as well. But we'll touch on that later on. And two of those albums were released this year, the latest released on Moshi Moshi Records, and the previous being a vinyl-only release album released on their own Wimsworld.
How do you pronounce it? Wimsworld.
Wimsworld, that's it, a label. So Dave, how are you doing, man?
Yeah, good. Yeah, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you. So I just wanted to first talk about A Season in Hull, the first album you released this year, which was recorded all in one sitting with one microphone. On your birthday, I believe.
Yeah.
A one microphone happy birthday recording, as you put it. What kind of experience was that, and what did it give to the album?
It was really fun. It was a really nice day. I couldn't think of anything, you know, that I'd rather do on my birthday than record.
Really, yeah.
It's the most fun thing I could imagine doing. So I just got loads of mates in. And we had the idea of doing it with one microphone, so it sounds very lively, I suppose.
It does, yeah.
It sounds very real. Just took a while to get the microphone in the right place with so many people in the room. But then, of course, once you've recorded it, there's no mixing afterwards.
Yeah.
So that's good, because mixing is really boring.
Yeah, I bet.
really boring. So I loved it. I always think that recording, you know, recording history, it started off with just recording with one microphone. So I always think it could have gone down the route of developing better and better microphones to record whole bands, rather than down the route of multi-tracking.
Yeah.
Which is just the way the technology went, and it's also a beautiful thing, lots of different ways, but it's not done anymore to record a whole band with one microphone, except maybe a few bluegrass purist bands.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe do that, like the Del McCorry band or whatever. But it's a very nice thing. Yeah, I like it. And then the other part of that album is we wanted it just to be a vinyl only, so it's not available in any other form.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah. People do make it their mission and record them and then put them on YouTube. Obviously, some of those songs.
Yeah, man,
it's really, really cool. And you got the idea from, is it Darren Heyman that suggested the idea to you originally, something like that?
Well, I was talking with him about how much I liked that. I liked the sound of old recordings. And we were talking about this record by Bill Munro and his band called, what's it called, Blue Yodel Number 7 or something.
Yeah.
I can't remember. Darren said you should do that, so it was his idea. Yeah, but that's how it came about. We were listening to Bill Munro.
It's super cool. I've got here on my little list of notes, compliment on the speed versus quality ratio. So it's in like the amount of time that you must have just kind of got the idea and then got all the songs together and made an album just like that, and it's super cool. And did you have quite a few people turn up as well? Did you invite people to kind of record with you and that kind of thing?
Yeah, there's Paul Rains is on there playing guitar. He's also on a newer album, Bamboo Diner in the Rain, pretty prominently. Paul is from Allo Darling and Tiger Cats.
Okay.
And there's a few other people. Dave Beauchamp's on percussion on there, and several people singing, just several friends around. So it was a party session, so probably 10 or so people knocking around, yeah.
I bet it was wicked.
Yeah, it was good fun.
I wanted to talk about that as well, the second album from this year, Bamboo Diner in the Rain, which is going to be our album of the week next week, and by the time that I play this interview, it'll probably be the album of the week, which is a very kind of bluesy number, as you've already discussed in other interviews. What was the kind of path that took the album in this direction?
Well, we wanted to try and make a blues album which didn't have any 12-bar blues on it.
Yeah.
We didn't want to make a white boy blues record.
Yeah.
But we listen to so much blues, and there's such a strong blues element of what we do anyway, what we always did.
Yeah, yeah.
We thought, how can we bring that element out, I suppose, without changing anything, without changing the style of the band at all, so that it seems completely natural. So that's what we sort of set out to do, and I think we probably recorded, you know, 30 or 40 songs one way or another to try and get at these eight, and then a couple of acoustic guitar instrumentals to sort of balance it out, I suppose.
Yeah.
That was the thinking, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
Boring answer, but it was, it's just because we love the blues,
yeah.
You know, but we don't want to be a blues band, you know, or a retro band.
Yeah, well, I read in another interview that you'd said you've tried to give the album much more of a soul feel rather than an interpretation of soul music. Like, there was quite a funny quote there about the White Stripes, which you'd made, which made me laugh.
yeah, I mean, I quite like the White Stripes, the early stuff.
Yeah, totally.
It gets a bit pretentious a bit quickly. But it is ham-fisted sort of white boy blues.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I don't think that they get very close to the soulful feeling that you get when you listen to John Lee Hooker.
Exactly, yeah.
And I think that's a very difficult thing to do, and I'm not saying that we managed to do it either, but that was the idea,
yeah.
Something a little bit more emotional and maybe a bit less poppy.
With a bit more
that
soul.
That was what we were trying to do. A bit more soul, yeah. That's what we were trying to, yeah.
And on to you guys a bit more technically. One of the things that stands out to me about the group, other than the like just the lyrical content, like the amazing lyrics in every song, they're all different, all these stories that are told. But it's the guitar playing. And while you've been doing it for such a long time, the sort of like varied and skilled guitar sounds featured in the music is amazing. Like in some songs, there's like just really long solos and some like sort of little riffs, you know, that go on for quite a while.
Yeah.
And where would you say the sort of group gauges its or gets its influences from with regard to the guitar playing? Like, where does all that come from?
Well, Neil Young and Rory Gallagher and Television and, you know, and all the blues stuff. Skip James and Robert Johnson and different kinds of American guitar music, I suppose, that you could say.
Yeah, yeah.
Rory. John Fay and, you know, I mean, Ike Turner we were obsessed with for a long time. So, surf guitar stuff as well. I mean, so there's a huge world of guitar playing, and the guitar's, you know, the guitar's been sort of hijacked. So now you just get horrible sort of show-off technical guitar magazine kind of players.
Yeah.
Or you kind of get bands where they don't really play the guitar at all. And it's such an expressive instrument, the guitar. I'm so in love with the guitar, you know, I've played it since I was six.
Yeah.
And it's just how I relate to music, really, altogether is through the guitar.
Yeah.
And it should be just as expressive and as emotional a part of it as the lyrics, really.
Yeah.
And this isn't how most people play the guitar. It's these days you either get sort of show-off technical guys or you get people who just use it as a texture, you know, a sound. They might as well be using a keyboard, really. They're not really playing the guitar. And
completely.
It's caused a lot of, you know, a lot of people don't like the wave pitches because of it.
because of the guitar playing?
Oh yeah, it causes a lot of people to either like it a lot or they hate it. You know, they just can't stand it. It's a divisive thing, but it's not meant to be. It's just meant to be another way to be expressive. Really, that's all it's meant to be.
Yeah, well, it's incredibly varied.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to talk about the lyrics as well, actually. All the songs have all these kind of stories and themes and very eloquently written, like spoken as well sometimes about like British towns and cities and all that kind of thing. Where do the kind of stories come from when you're writing these music? And is it something that comes before the music or is it all like part and parcel?
I always write the lyrics first.
Yeah.
But then what I do is I write far more lyrics than that you could possibly need.
Yeah.
So just get as much as I can down on paper, and then when I come to play the guitar and write the music, I have a lot of lyrics to choose from, and then I edit, and get them down to begin with. What I can't do at all, I've tried it and I cannot do it, though lots of people seem to find it very easy, is I can't have a song and then write lyrics that fit over the top of it. I don't know why,
yeah.
But it just doesn't work for me at all. And I have to have the lyrics first, independently of thinking about music at all.
Yeah.
Just to splurge them out of my brain, really, as much as I can. I can fill a whole notebook or something before I'll even start picking up the guitar. That's the other thing that I do, is I don't write the lyrics for one song and then set music to it, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
I write loads and loads, 100 pages, and then maybe I'll write 10 songs, you know, with 100 pages edited down a lot, and then
Jesus.
I'll get rid of it and start again. So it's much easier for me to do it that way.
Yeah. How have you done that for so long? Like, just
how?
Yeah, just writing so many lyrics all the time. 15 years or whatever it's been, 16
years. Yeah, it's completely easy. It's not you just get in the habit of. It's not a struggle at all. It's a very very pleasant, easy part of it.
Yeah.
Of it all. The hard part is much harder. Is getting people to listen to your new stuff.
Yeah.
But it's not hard to make new stuff up.
Yeah.
It's just fun. And I suppose you just get addicted to it, or you get in the habit of it. So
yeah.
You go for a little walk and you see some lyrics. It's very easy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I read another quote from an interview. Making music is just a fun thing to do, and then you have to pretend.
Yeah.
Then you have to pretend that you've made something special afterwards, but it's kind of a white lie, which is really interesting because. And that also paired with the fact that you have mentioned potentially turning down certain nominations if they arrived. Like, I just wanted to know, is the music industry in its current state like something that maybe gets your goat, so to speak, or is it something like the fact that the critical and fan reception is something that comes very much as an afterthought?
Well, there's so many different parts of that to that question.
There is.
But I definitely think that an odd element about being a musician is that you are sort of required to boast about yourself, and you don't really want to do that at all. And obviously, you know, it's just fun to make stuff up. People get very precious about it, but it's just you've only just done it for fun, and you know, it's very easy. It's not the hard part, you know. So the hard part of being in a band, I suppose, touring and being away from home can be hard. It can also be really fun. And then the other stuff that you're talking about, the record business does seem pretty vile.
Yeah.
And it sort of always has done. I think it's always been a very corrupt and unpleasant business. And even a small band like us have been ripped off. People have attempted to rip us off when there's nothing to rip. There's nothing to rip off. There's not enough money in it. People have even tried to do terrible things to us. You know, let alone, I mean, the stories that you hear about other bands. Even now, they're just as awful what happens to them as that it ever was.
Yeah, it's nasty.
Not going to name any names, obviously, but you hear terrible things, and the music business is awful.
Yeah,
and of course they don't know what they're doing. You know, and they never have known what they're doing, and they're very upset now that they're not really making any money anymore.
Go on.
I'm just rambling.
I was only going to ramble anyway. I was just going to say it does seem like. With a lot of people that we interview, like one question that I'll often ask is, what's it been like working with this certain label or whatever?
Yeah.
And that's usually a question that people are like, yeah, you know, it's all right, it's not bad, but it doesn't really factor into it, really. The kind of industry is usually the more hard part, and it's kind of the more difficult thing to get over, and it's not really in the creative kind of mental sphere of it.
No.
No.
That's true.
I wanted to also talk about sort of music communities, because we in a lot of interviews we talk to artists, and there's various families and communities. So, like, for example, there's this sort of Welsh independent music scene that's all very collaborative and kind of bounce off each other. And with you guys as well, as I've mentioned, you collaborated with Stanley Brinks, with who you did two albums. And then Freshard, who has also worked with Stanley. And so there's like a lot of artists that kind of form this kind of community, like Jeffrey Lewis and all these people. What would you say that brings you and these people to work together in particular?
Well, they've been friends, for Stanley Brinks and Jeff Lewis, for such a long time. And I think it's really good fun to collaborate. So we've done things like the thing with Billy Childish.
Yeah.
Where we didn't know him before. Stanley Brinks and Jeff Lewis, they're very old friends, really. And I don't know what it is we have in common. but I actually think that Jeff Lewis has a very different style of songwriting. He's kind of a message songwriter.
Yeah.
And it's not really my style of songwriting. I don't really think we're too similar musically. We just happen to be friends.
Yeah.
Well, and Stanley Brinks, I feel more similar to. I think he's a similar type of writer.
Yeah.
To me, and has a similar sort of attitude about the business and everything.
Yeah.
And you know, but he's really aggressive, Stanley Brinks. He's really a lunatic, really. That doesn't want any part. He won't compromise at all. You know, but I'm more reasonable.
Yeah.
But
good cop, bad cop.
Who were the other ones that you mentioned?
What have we got? We've got a little list at the beginning here. Daniel Johnston, Freshard as well. Freshard, who?
Yeah. Daniel Johnston was not a friend of ours, but we got to be his band for a tour,
yeah,
which was really, really wonderful and such a happy memory, and I just love his songs so much. So yeah.
I'm really
happy playing guitar for him.
I wanted to jump back to this kind of industry question. You continually get huge championing, and it's how I found out about you. But Mark Riley,
yeah,
you know, he loves you guys, and it must be going so long and having like being renowned by someone that's so renowned himself. You know, and you know, must be kind of both great and confusing. Confusing at the same time, like
it's brilliant, and he's such a lovely bloke, Mark. I don't think we could carry on working without his support, because we've had so little support from anywhere else, really, is the truth, that to do a UK tour or something, we couldn't go and play in Newcastle or Sheffield or whatever without Mark Riley's support. People still just come up to us and they always say, "I heard you first on Mark Riley."
Yeah.
And of course, they're not going to hear it anywhere else, which is frustrating, but he's become so important to us, really, because I think, he's given us a chance to play to people in England.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when we used to tour in Spain and Germany in particular, we could play to audiences all over. But right from the get-go, from when we first started touring, we had audiences in those countries. But in England, in our own country, we really didn't.
Yeah.
You know, even after we'd put out four albums on a record label, we'd go and play in Manchester, say, and there'd be four people there, you know.
Yeah.
So it's only really in the last 2-3 years that we can go and play and that anyone will come to the show. So even though we've been going a very long time, it's only been the last couple of years, really, last 2 or 3 years, where audiences have come all over England.
Yeah.
You know, I'm only talking about 100 people or 200 people, but enough people to have a show. And that's because of Mark Riley. That's not because of anybody else. That's because of him.
It's cool. It's cool what he does. Despite the fact that music is subjective, he does know what he's talking about, Mark Riley, when it comes to music. And he's so unbelievably passionate, which is why he knows what he's talking about. You seem to have a huge following in France, actually. French people seem to dig you quite a lot.
Well, it's very difficult for us to get to tour in France. So these French people, they should rise up
yeah.
and and they should force these promoters, because it's driving us crazy that these promoters won't put us on in France, but every time we've been to France to play, there's always an audience that's very happy audience all over France. You know, we sell out venues, so I can't understand what the problem is. It's very frustrating. And a lot of our friends have this problem with France, that it's difficult to get shows in France.
Maybe we'll start getting people to rise up.
Yeah,
start a hashtag or something.
Yeah, sure.
Hashtag get wavy.
Yeah.
just before I say goodbye, Dave, you're gonna be playing in Bordeaux on the 3rd. That's the first sort of French date that I've seen.
Yeah.
And then there were rumours within the office here that you might be playing in Nantes on the 2nd. I don't know whether that's a thing or not.
I don't know. I'm afraid I'm terrible for just not knowing what we're doing. Yeah. And Frannick, the bass player, is the one who organises all of that kind of thing.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, we'll find out anyway. And
people, watch out for it anyway.
Yeah, people can go see you in Bordeaux, if not in France.
Yeah.
Well, listen, Dave, thank you very much for talking to us. I'm sure that everyone's enjoying the album of the week when this goes out. We've been playing it anyway prior to this interview. It is amazing. And we wish you the best of luck with everything and hope to see you around here soon.
Yeah, well, thank you very much.
Cheers, Dave.
Cheers, man.
English for Everyone, the show that brings you the best of European music and cultural interviews from here in Nantes and all across the continent.